We're studying now from the book of 1 Peter, chapter 3, and we're in verse 14. So we had finished that section down through from 10 to 12, where he was quoting the passage from Psalm 34 about the fear of the Lord, teaching that, where it's applied here that love for righteousness, for what is good, to see and do the good, the hatred of evil, and putting away all evil. That is applied here as the foundation, really, for being able to endure all the sufferings that we have to go through for doing the Lord's will. So we're going to do God's will, which we have to have. If we're going to do His will in the first place, we have to have some. We have to be able to see some good. We also have to have some love for that good, and also some hatred of evil to put that away to do the good. I mean, so there we have to have. Can we be a Christian and not have any fear of the Lord? I mean, that would be impossible, because we could never repent if we didn't have that. So that's necessary for us to even be a Christian. But does that grow stronger? Well, yes, because this is part of our inner man, and we have to grow to the point where we love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. So how much of a love for what is good and righteous can we have? And how much of that hatred of evil? Well, we need to follow Christ, who loved righteousness and hated iniquity, as he describes him in Hebrews 1 when he's quoting from a prophecy in the Psalms of Christ there. So we have him as our example to follow. He brings that up over and over again. In fact, he's about to do the same thing just a couple of more verses down from where we are. So he's going to come back to that once again. Christ is our example to follow, the footsteps he's left us to walk in enduring sufferings for righteousness' sake. But we need to have the fear of the Lord. It's going to be necessary to get us through all of the trials on our faith and all those persecutions and tribulations we have to face as Christians. So he brought it back. It started off with that, actually, before quoting Psalm 34 back in verse 9 when he was telling us there about how we are not to render evil for evil, or railing for railing, but contrarywise blessing. So he's talking about when we are being mistreated because we are doing the Lord's will. Well, that's also what he taught us in verse 13, or 13 and 14, where he asked the question in verse 13, "Who is he that will harm you if you be followers of that which is good?" And we studied through that last week, and we noted that, well, if we're answering the question in a more of a short-sighted manner, we'd say, well, there are plenty of people that would harm us for doing what is good. But when we look at it in terms of that harm to our souls, does any man have that power? And that answer is no. If God be for us, who can be against us? So he's going to deliver us from all of these things, but we have to have that fear of the Lord to seek him and do his will, and to be able to endure sufferings for righteousness' sake and continue to do his will even through all of those things. And so that's where he continued in verse 14, and we got through the first part of that last week when he says, "But, and if you suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are you." And he uses that same word that's translated blessing. So blessed are you, and we compared that to what he teaches in Matthew 6 on the Sermon on the Mount, where he uses that same word, and blessed are they that suffer for righteousness' sake. And so he teaches, uses the same word, same subject there. And in what way are we blessed if we suffer for righteousness' sake? He says we are. Well, in what way does he ever tell us how we're blessed if we suffer for righteousness' sake? We gain his favor. That's what he taught us in chapter 2. We please him by being willing to obey him even through sufferings, and to walk in the steps of his son that he left us to follow and called us to follow in. So we're going to grow in his favor. That's a blessing. We're also, along with that, with his favor, as we endure those things, what is he doing in our inner man? He's forming our inner man into all of the parts of his love, which is his image, and in the image of his son. And that's what we have in James chapter 1, 2 through 4, when he tells us to count it all joy when we fall into diverse temptations. He says, knowing this. Well, what helps us to count it all joy? Knowing what? That the trying of your faith works patience. So we grow in endurance when we endure. So if we endure some now, we'll be able to endure more later. And then that work of endurance, that work of patience, when completed, will make us, if we let her have her patience have a perfect work, then we will be complete and entire, lacking nothing. So there is it a blessing to be growing spiritually? Is it a blessing to be more like Christ? Is it a blessing to become complete and entire, lacking nothing, which is the purpose of our God who's called us to walk in the steps of Christ? Well, is that a blessing to have that? In Matthew 6, where we read, where Jesus said that we're blessed if we suffer for righteousness' sake, what did he say is another blessing, another reason for that? Great is our reward which is in heaven. So there's going to be an eternal reward for it. So in how many ways are we blessed by God if we do his will and continue to do it even through those sufferings that will come for doing what's right? So there's many ways in which he teaches us that we are truly blessed and eternally so. So the ones that bring those persecutions upon us, they don't have power over our souls. God does. And so they're only able to do something that lasts for how long? Yeah, well, that would be the maximum degree. But how long, even if we were born in, well, of course, we don't understand righteousness on day one, but if from the first day that we understand anything about righteousness, if we got attacked by Satan at that moment, which that's pretty much what happens, but if we were being persecuted nonstop with no break from that moment until we left this earth, how long would that, and we know it's not that way, because the Lord tells us if we resist the devil, he will flee from us. The Lord will give us rest from that. Of course, we're going to have to go through another trial again, but it's not a continuous life of nonstop suffering. That's not what he says. In fact, he says differently than that. But there are many trials and much that we have to go through. However much that is, how long does it last? Just a little while, because we're not here but for a short time. Our life is, as we know from what he tells us in James chapter 4, it's like a vapor that appears for a little time, and then it vanishes away. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, when he reminds us of the difference between the outer man and the inner man, and what's happening with each simultaneously when we're following Christ, and then he tells us about these afflictions that we're going through and the reward that is to come. So in 2 Corinthians 4, verses 16 and 17, he says, "For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day." Well, and he's talking about afflictions. And, I mean, the outer man is perishing by age. So, I mean, we're slowly, because it's temporal, as he says in the next verse, in verse 18, those things that are seen are temporal. But there's also that aspect of the persecution. And we could be, have our life brought to an end from that. But what happens to the outer man it does perish one way or another. But at the same time, what is happening with our inner man? It's being renewed, he says, day by day. That is when we are doing the Lord's will, and that's going to involve and require enduring many sufferings for doing his will. Well, he says that we're going to be renewed. We're going to be getting stronger in the inner man. So while our outer man is getting older, weaker, and suffering those things that we suffer in the flesh, at the same time, the Lord's forming our inner man to be more like him. So we are getting stronger and better every day. And then he says in verse 17 that our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. So he compares the degree and the duration of our affliction with that of the reward that will come for enduring those afflictions. Well, when he speaks of the degree, what is the affliction? What is the word that he uses to describe it? Our light affliction, the reward, how does he describe it? That great weight. So in degree, what we get for reward for enduring the affliction, is it equal? No, it's not even close to equal. The reward that we're going to have is far greater in terms of the degree of whatever affliction we're going through. He's going to reward us much greater than that. So that's the degree. What about the duration? How long does the affliction last? What does he say? But for a moment. What does he say about the reward? It is eternal. Is that why Romans 8:18 says that the sufferings of this time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that shall be revealed? I mean, there is no comparison. When he tells us he's talking about both what's going on in our inner man now that we're growing in, as well as the reward in eternity that is to come. So multiple blessings if we are willing to endure those sufferings for righteousness' sake. So the question is it worth it? When he's describing that. Yes, it is worth it. Now, we could look at it from the most basic standpoint. It's worth it because it's right. God made us, so we belong to him. So who should we serve? We should serve him. Is that principle based on how difficult the service may be? Or do we owe him our service regardless? We do. I mean, we should be willing to do his will and do it through sufferings because that's right. We're his. He's our God. He's our creator. He is a good creator. And we know that he's good. And so he's, how many times does he tell us in the Psalms, his mercy endureth forever? I mean, his goodness, his mercy, it's everlasting. And so God does care greatly for us. So he doesn't call us to go through something that we can't bear. It's not something that is exceeding in terms of its duration or its magnitude, especially compared to what he's promising for a reward. So we have all of that encouragement. We are serving a righteous creator. So we have much encouragement for that. From that, we need to keep in mind that we should do his will through everything because we owe him our service, because he made us. At the same time, we have a very good God who is promising and fulfilling all of these blessings for us for doing his will. We think about that. We are doing, when we have done all that he's told us to do, in the basic sense, are we really a profitable servant? Or are we doing what's right? Well, we are. But then God rewards us for doing what we should do anyway. How good is he? And it encourages us. There's no question about that. And we're seeing much of that right here. And so he continues here in verse 14, the second half. So he's after reminding us of the blessings, he then says, "And be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled." Well, he reminds us of that. Does it help us to do that last part when he's reminded us first of the blessings we have for suffering for righteousness' sake? Yes. So he's giving us great encouragement, but then he tells us don't be afraid of their terror, and don't be troubled. Well, what would happen? And can't we start focusing on the pain of it all and what could happen to us and get ourselves fearful of what could happen? I mean, none of us wants to be killed because we're following Christ. That's not what we are hoping for or asking for. It happens with some. We don't know what's going to happen to us in the future. And we would all greatly desire that the Lord would not be his will, that we have to have that happen to us. There are many who have, and they weren't desiring for that either. What did the Lord tell Peter? There was a day coming when he would be carried where he would not. Is that where he would rather go? When he would be carried to his execution for following Christ? No. But it happened, and when that was the Lord's will, did he do it? He did. Whatever the Lord requires of us, we must do. But should we be thinking about, well, this could have, this bad thing could happen, or this could get this much worse, and that could really hurt, or whatever it is. I mean, we could get on that track, and then what happens if we're just thinking of that? Then where does that lead us? Yes, that fear, and then with that fear, what happens then? I mean, why does Revelation 21:8, when he's saying those who have their part in the lake of fire, what's the first that he mentions? But the fearful and unbelieving, and then he gives the rest of the list, but the fearful. Well, what did the one in the parable of the talents, the one that was given the one talent, what did he do with it? He buried it in the ground in a napkin, and what was the reason? He was afraid. So when we are fearful, do we serve well in fear? That kind of, now we're not talking about the fear of the Lord now, we're talking about being afraid of men, of what's happening to us for doing the Lord's will. I mean, the devil wants us to get afraid like that, because then that, it's not a long step from there to giving up and quitting. Do any do that? What's the stony ground in the parable of the sower? Non-Christians or Christians? Christians who do what? Well, that plant springs up like it does on a rock. So if there's no plant, if it's not talking about Christians, there'd be no plant that would spring up. But he's talking about those who hear the word and anon with joy receive it. But when tribulation arises, and he says when it arises because of the word, by and by they're offended. That's not that they have their feelings hurt. That's not what that word means. But they're ensnared, as in a trap, like you would set to trap an animal that you're trying to catch. And so they become ensnared because, he says, they have no root. They fall away. And so when Jesus is warning, and he has an entire category in that parable of the sower about Christians who quit doing his will because of the tribulation? Does it happen? Why would he give such a warning about it if it weren't, that never happens. I mean, no, it does. And it can happen to us. And here's one of the things he teaches us to help us not to to have that happen. I mean, we need that root, that understanding of what his purpose is, how this is, God uses this to form us in his image, how much he blesses us through that. So he's giving us all of that encouragement, but he's also warning us against what the devil's going to try to get us to do that will take us on the away from him to where we might become offended, that we might fall away and quit. And so he tells us not to be afraid. He says not be afraid of their terror. It's kind of interesting because that word afraid there, it's phobeo, which is a form of phobos, which is what the word that is terror. So don't be afraid of their fear. Well, they're not afraid of us, but what are they trying to do? What is one of the goals that the devil has and the ones that are doing his bidding and bringing persecution upon us? What do they want us to do? They want us to be afraid. They want us to be fearful. So he says, don't fall for that. Don't be afraid when they're trying to make you afraid. And he says, and neither be you troubled. That word troubled, of course, phobos, and its forms, that's the word, just the basic word for fear. I mean, that's when we talk about having a phobia of something. I mean, that's where what that word means. That's where we get it in our language. But it's being afraid of something. But we shouldn't fear men. And these ones that are trying to do evil to us. That word troubled here is the Greek word tarasso. And it's a word that means to stir or agitate. And it really has the sense of as in water. You remember in John chapter 5, there was an impotent man who had not walked in his life. He sat by the pool of Siloam there in Jerusalem. And every so often, what would happen? An angel of God would stir the water. That's the word here. That's the same. It's actually tarasso, is that word there, when he's describing how the water would be stirred or agitated. So he uses that word twice there in John 5 when he's describing what would happen there. Of course, whoever would get to the water would then have a healing of their infirmity, but this man couldn't walk, so he could never get there in time. So I think it was 37 years, wasn't it? What's that? 38. I shortchanged him a year. Right, 38. So that was a long time, but then the Lord healed him. Then they were mad at him because it was on the Sabbath day. But anyway, these enemies of the Lord are, they're something else, but they don't understand. They do not know what they're doing. But they're doing the Lord's, they're doing the devil's bidding, though they don't recognize that. And that's why Jesus said that they didn't know what they were doing to him. But this word that he used there in the sense of physically, like what is done to the water there in John 5, that's the same word he uses about us and when he says for us not to be troubled. Well, it's easy to become that way. So we might first be afraid and then we can be stirred or agitated. Well, this is not a good thing if we get like that, because that's the track that can get us to start thinking, well, this isn't worth it. I don't want this to happen. And then turn away from the Lord and from continuing to do his will. Does that mean that when we're in the midst of it, we're not going to feel that, some stirring or agitation? Or, in fact, what did he say in 1 Peter 1 and verse 6? That we are to do, when we count it all joy, though we are in what? Heaviness through manifold temptations. Well, is there any way in which there's pressure on us that we feel the heaviness and we feel the trouble in that sense? Well, yes, in fact, even Christ, what did he say in John 12, verse 27? He says, "Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this cause came I unto this hour." So Jesus, did he feel that pressure? He was made like us in every way. But he understood what the Father's will was, so did he let that carry him into fear, and then that being stirred up or agitated to where he would not do his Father's will through those sufferings? No, he did not. He took that captive, and then when he was feeling that, he said, "This is my Father's will, and I'm going to do his will." And if we start feeling that welling up, and when the devil's after us, what do we need to do? We need to take it captive. We need to think about, okay, this is my Father's will. These are the steps of Christ. Here's, remind ourselves of what he's reminding us of. Here's what it's for. Here's what he's doing. And he's going to provide a way. He's going to enable us to get through it, so we can trust in him and commit ourselves to him, our faithful Creator, like Christ did, that one who judged, he committed himself to him that judges righteously. We need to do the same thing. But we can see with that example of Christ, he felt that. I mean, that's why he had those sweats, as it were, great drops of blood when he was facing what he was facing. But he knew it was his Father's will, and he was going to accomplish that will. Another instance where Jesus uses that word about him is in John 13:21. And we should be able to understand why it was so. It says, "When Jesus had thus said, he was troubled in spirit." And there's that word, tarasso, again, where he had agitation in his spirit. Well, what was it from? It says, "And testified and said, verily, verily, I say unto you that one of you shall betray me." Now, was this fresh news to Jesus that one of the 12 that he had chosen had turned on him and was now betraying him? I mean, it was a fresh event. I mean, Satan had entered into, in fact, it's the beginning of chapter 13. Fat Brother Johnson was preaching from this text not too long ago. But it spoke of Judas in verse 2 of this very chapter, and how the devil had put into his heart to betray Jesus. So the events had just, they were unfolding right then. And then, I mean, while he was eating the supper and he dipped in the bowl with him, as Jesus said that would identify the one who would do that. And then what did he tell him? "What thou doest, do quickly." He didn't try to pin him down and stop him, did he? Why not? Well, he knew all of that. In fact, I mean, you go back to John. Brother Johnson was preaching from John 6 this past Sunday. Well, what does it say at the very end of John 6? What did Jesus say? "Have not I chosen you, and one of you is a what? A devil." That was in John 6. Well, that was a long time before that actually happened. So Did Jesus make a mistake when he chose somebody like that? What about the Psalms that foretold it? Jesus knew exactly. Why did he spend all night in prayer before he chose his apostles? He had to choose all 12 exactly according to what would accomplish his Father's will. And for 11 of them, that would be ones that the Lord would use to turn the world upside down. That would be his faithful messengers to send out, which is what an apostle is, one that was sent. They would be sent to the world to preach the gospel, and they would do it as he sent them to do. But one would have the job of betraying him and fulfill all that was foretold of him. And did Jesus have to make that choice correctly? He had to make that choice correctly, and did. So it wasn't that Jesus didn't know when he was choosing them. He chose Judas, and he knew exactly who he was choosing and what for. So this wasn't a shock to him now that Judas was doing that. We may have experienced something like that before, where somebody that we trusted greatly turned on us in some way. And then that feeling of betrayal, I mean, it is a shock, and that'll hit us hard. But was Jesus shocked from that standpoint? Was it somebody, did Jesus trust Judas? He trusted him to betray him. Yeah, he did. But as far as trusting him as somebody that was his friend, no. He knew exactly what his heart was. But still, to have someone do that action where he knew he was going out and was about to go out and get those ones to bring him, to bring all that upon him with that death, he was going to die the following day. And having all of that was something that that did bring trouble in his spirit. But again, he took all of that, all of those thoughts captive to the obedience of his Father, as we have to do. And so that's what Jesus taught us. John 14:1. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. Same word, and the same thing he's telling us there in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 14. Not to be troubled. Brother Glenn?
We look at the example of Peter, and Jesus was never afraid. I mean, if he'd been afraid when he told Peter to come out on the water, Jesus would have started sinking himself.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And this is the right track. And why wasn't Jesus afraid? Well, that he just gave the answer right there in John 14:1, and what will keep us from being overtaken with fear and being troubled and then sinking spiritually through those tribulations. He says, you believe in God, believe also in me. That's the foundation of it. We have to believe in him and we have to trust him. So we have to commit our souls to our faithful Creator, commit ourselves to that one who judges righteously. Do we trust him enough that when he's promising that he's going to, if we don't really believe what he says, and he tells us that he's not, and we're really building on what we were studying Sunday night in our lesson, these exceeding great and precious promises, these better promises that this covenant is based on. Well, he tells us that he's not going to let us be tempted above what we can bear. He's going to provide a way through it that we can bear it. Do we believe that? Do we believe when he says he will never leave us nor forsake us? Do we believe him when he says that he is going to give us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory as a reward for going through that? We're going to have the resurrection of the dead. If we don't believe those things, then how far are we going to get with any of this? I mean, without faith, it's impossible to please him. We're not going to get anywhere in following him without believing in him. But this is where that faith is being tested. When we're suffering temptation, when we're being persecuted for doing what's right. Well, do we believe him now? Do we believe those promises now? Are we going to still do his will? Or are we going to start getting fearful and doubting and let ourselves get troubled and then what happens? That was a good comparison, because then we sink, like you said. This is the remedy for that, so that doesn't happen. In the same chapter, John 14, as he started it in verse 1, where our hearts should not be troubled, we believe in God and we need to believe in his Son. Well, later in the chapter, near the end in verse 27, he says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." So the same thing that he teaches in 1 Peter 3:14, he also teaches us there. Well, we need to obey that and not be fearful and troubled through these things that happen to us. All right. Well, then verse 15 comes up. What do we need to do through this? Now, we're not going to be doing this if we're full of fear and trouble at being persecuted. But going back to the beginning of the chapter, for the Christian woman who's suffering, being persecuted because she's now a follower of Christ and her husband isn't yet. But what's a big part of her motivation for continuing to follow Christ and to have that chaste behavior coupled with fear? What's one of the main goals that she's going to have through that? Well, of course, the goal's for herself, but she's not just thinking about herself, is she? What did it say? What might happen through that good behavior? Yeah, her husband might be saved. In that context, he's the persecutor. Well, likewise, you husband. So if it's the other way around, I mean, this chapter's already dealt with that, and how we do need to think about what these things are accomplishing for us when we are being persecuted, the blessings that we have from it. But how much do we have to trust the Lord not only to continue to do his will through those things, but also then to be thinking about how following Christ might impact the very ones that are bringing this on us in a good way, to pray for them and to do good for them, which is exactly what Jesus did, didn't he? When he was nailed to the cross, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Why didn't he, and they're multiple aspects of this. The ultimate answer to the question we're about to ask is, of course, because it was his Father's will, but to go to the cross and endure that and despise the shame and go through, drink that cup. But why didn't he come down? They said, "Come down from the cross if you be the Son of God and we'll believe you." Now, if he had come down from right then, would they have believed him? No, they would not have. But that's not the reason why he didn't come down from the cross. But what was he doing by his death for the very ones saying those words? He was praying for them and dying for them. I mean, what ended up happening on the day of Pentecost? There were about 3,000 that became his disciples. That 7 weeks before, what were they doing? They had their part. I mean, Pilate, if there hadn't been a mob lifting up their voices, "Crucify him, crucify him," would Pilate have consented for Christ to be crucified just because of a few envious, the high priest and his people, just for that? No. But when you had all those people putting in their voices, crucify him, he pacified the mob by giving Christ over to be crucified. All of that was fulfillment of what God had foretold, but those very ones on the day of Pentecost had been part of that mob. And they had had, and that's why Peter said, whom ye have crucified. I mean, they didn't drive the nails in, but they had their part in it. But there, 7 weeks later, now they are wearing his name. They become Christians. Well, could that have happened if Jesus hadn't died for them? No. So what's he teaching us here and for us to do? Well, we've seen it here in chapter 3 already. We do need to be thinking about ourselves, but as he already told us in verse 9, rather than doing evil to or railing on the ones doing the evil to us, what does he say we should do in verse 9 that we saw, of course, that the Lord has taught us to do, that he did? He says, blessing. Well, we should do that because the Lord teaches us to do that, but there's another aspect of it. If we do that, might their hard heart soften? Is there any possibility that somebody that's doing that, if they're doing evil to somebody because they follow Christ, and then they're seeing the heart of Christ on display by their behavior, and they're being blessed by the one that they're doing these evil things to? I mean, there's some people that would stop and give, and if it's not even on that very moment, it could happen in time, as in 7 weeks later with that group there on Pentecost. But verse 15 comes in here. So after he's told us about how we're blessed if we suffer for righteousness' sake, and not be afraid of their terror, not to be troubled, but, this is part of the same sentence, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. So what is one of the things that we should be thinking about when we go through these persecutions, to endure them, and especially not to do evil to the ones that are doing evil to us? Convert them. Now, we don't ever know what happened to Malchus in the end. But at the moment when he met Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane, how effective was Peter at that moment as far as being any tool to convert Malchus to being Christ's disciple as he's cutting off his ear with a sword? What's that? Yeah. That's right. He got part of it, but... Yep.
We're instructed to meekness, instruct others, so they might be able to recover themselves out of the snare of death. Because we were there too, right?
Yes, that's right. And we need to, and he starts that passage in 2 Timothy 2:24 by saying that the servant of the Lord must not strive, but we need to be able to teach others and do so in meekness, which is a word he's going to use right here in verse 15 of 1 Peter 3. We need to all be prepared, ready to do that, to serve the Lord and be able to render that service, to be able to teach somebody else what they need to know to become a follower of Christ. That's in general. But to be ready to do that to the very ones who are persecuting us for following him. Now, that's on a different plane, isn't it? But that's what he says we need to be ready to do. So for us to get to the point where we're not just thinking about, I got to get through this, here's what the Lord's will is, and I've got to continue to do his will through these sufferings, we've got to do that, and we've seen all of what he teaches to help us do that. But what about growing to the point where we're not just thinking about, well, what we've got to do there, but from the standpoint of how we can also be a tool in the Lord's hands to possibly convert some of the ones that are bringing the persecution on us. So whether it's a wife or husband, as we saw earlier in the chapter, or in whatever way it is in our lives. And if we are speaking roughly, if we're reviling them back, if we're doing evil to them when they do evil to us, well, we've failed a test, and we're not doing the Lord's will then. But we're not, what kind of example are we setting at that moment? I mean, as far as being able to be an example of Christ, we've failed that if we start doing evil to the ones that are doing evil to us. But also we can see why it's important not just to not do evil, but to do them good, to bless them. Does that mean that most people that cause us trouble for following Christ are going to become a Christian because we still follow Christ even through those persecutions? He doesn't say that. Can it happen? We've already seen that it can. And do we know? Do we have sight to know when somebody's persecuting us, if that's somebody that the Lord can see good in? Well, who was the chief persecutor of the church after it was established? Who wreaked havoc on it? Yes, Saul of Tarsus. And what did God do with him? I mean, he became the one that we're told to follow as he followed Christ. And we can only imagine what that would have been like for Christians in that time to have received the news that he had been converted. And, of course, we're told what the reaction was in that time, which we can understand. Were there some that just didn't believe it? It was very difficult for them to accept that. The Lord did that. But if we'd been around then, would we have thought, well, that Saul of Tarsus, he's somebody that could be converted, and look at all the good he could do for the Lord's kingdom. I mean, that would have been a good way to think, but would we have looked at him and thought that was one and expected that to happen? Yeah. And the fact is, he sees what we can't. And we don't know. I mean, the fact is, with him, all things are possible. So we should not cast away that hope that the Lord might use us to help somebody that's persecuting us. We can think of other examples of that. Paul and Silas, and when they were in Philippi and they were in the prison, they were singing hymns about midnight. An earthquake came and opened the prison. But then when they were singing there, they weren't singing because they physically felt terrific. They had just been beaten with stripes. So they were in physical pain, but they were still singing hymns. And the one that laid the stripes on him was about to kill himself, the jailer, because he thought the prisoners had escaped, which would cost him his life in his position. But Paul said, do yourself no harm, we're all here. And then preached the gospel that night to the one that had put the stripes on him. And then he washed their stripes. So he did good in return for the good that was done to him. But here, I mean, if Paul and Silas had handled that differently, would they have been in a position to have converted? I mean, who would have been expecting that jailer to have been converted that night? But he was. So we do have a number of examples of this. So he tells us to sanctify the Lord God in our hearts. Well, the Lord is already sanctified, and he's holy. We already saw that in chapter 1. God is holy. So what does he mean when he says, sanctify the Lord God in your hearts? To make him holy in our hearts. Well, to do what he's talking about doing there, here in verse 15, if our heart's given to anything else but serving him, are we going to be able to do what he's talking about doing here in verse 15? No. Our heart has to be fully given to the Lord to do what he's speaking of and what he's teaching us to do there. As he says, to be ready always. That word ready is, it literally means adjusted. We do have to adjust ourselves. That's what getting ready. And that's the common word for being ready. The Lord tells us to be ready for his coming, his return. Matthew 24:44, Luke 12:40. So we are to be ready for his return. We're also to be ready unto every good work, Titus 3:1. Well, to do that, I mean, how much, if we're only living for the Lord some, well, what if he comes at one of those moments when we're not doing his will? And that's something to think about, because, I mean, we can check ourselves if we're about to do something. You know, is this where we'd want to be, or what we'd want to be doing when the Lord returns? We need to think about that. If we're always doing his will, then the answer of that question will always be yes. And that should be the answer. And we need to be ready into every good work. Well, here, look at this good work. So we need to sanctify the Lord God in our hearts and be ready always, not just sometimes, but ready always. And this is why we need to be. We need to be ready always, including when we're being persecuted, because we might have an opportunity. Because if they curse us or do something evil to us, we bless them and do good to them, then they might ask us, because who else would do this but a Christian? I mean, this is, as we've noted before, this is one of those criteria that we have to meet as a Christian that really makes us distinct from the world. When we are willing to do good and love our enemies, who else does that but a Christian? And so if we do that, is there anybody that might say, why do you have this hope in you? They might want to know about that. If that was impossible, why would he tell us to be ready for that moment? We need to be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Well, ready always. And I mean, there's a general application to that. Do we need to be ready always to give an answer to somebody that asks us that, even if they're not persecuting us? Well, of course. But in this context, it would include, and it really is, especially at that time, we need to be ready. And that will only happen, that we're only going to be asked the reason of the hope that is in us if we've been displaying it by continuing to do the Lord's will through those very persecutions. But one of the things, the Lord may reward us by doing his will there, by giving us an opportunity now to proclaim his son and his gospel to somebody, or might be more than that. But we need to be ready for that. We need to be praying for them for that. That's part of what the Lord told us to do, for us to pray for the ones who are persecuting us, to bless them when they curse us. And they might ask us a reason of that hope that is in us, but they've got to see that hope on display by our doing the Lord's will through those persecutions. We want to bring in fact, we want to look at that passage that Brother Michael mentioned tonight with a couple of others, Lord willing, when we start next week. The Lord tells us to be ready here to always to give this answer. Well, there's going to be the content and the manner of what we're going to say to, or what we should say to others. What should we say and how should we say it? And we need to pay attention to both parts of that, both elements there, because they are both vitally important and taught by the Lord in a lot of places. So, as a preview, of course, we've got to give the answer. And it's interesting when he says the reason of the hope that is in you. That word reason is logos. That's the Greek word for word. And we're going to have to give an answer. And whose words are we going to give to answer about the reason of the hope that is in us? God's word. That's the content. And then how do we speak God's word? And so we have to speak the truth in love, as he tells us in Ephesians 4:15. And so there's what to speak, that word of God, not our own words. We've got to speak as the oracles of God, and then we have to do so in the right manner for the Lord to be able to use us fully as an effective tool in his hand to spread his word or teach that to others. So Lord willing, we'll delve into that more in our study next time.